the most ridiculous sight the world has ever seen, I believe, was that of 101 fully armed men guarding a tomb. He's dead, and they know he's dead. And yet, through the long night, they maintain their watch with weapons heavy in their hands. 101 men guarding a grave. This morning, we're going to go back and rethink and re-celebrate the greatest story ever told, the story of the death, burial, and powerful resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ. We're going to talk about time and place, chronology, topography, and geography. When did Jesus die? In the spring of the year, over 2,000 years ago, on a Friday that the world calls good, just before the beginning of the seventh day Sabbath. That's when he died. Now, where did he die? That's going to become important to our study this morning. We have Bible information for that. So, firstly, we're going to go to John's Gospel, chapter 19. John chapter 19, and I'm going to read, while you follow with me, the 20th verse. John's Gospel, chapter 19, verse 20. Leave a bookmark here, by the way, because soon we'll be back. John 19 and the 20th verse. This title then read many of the Jews, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near to the city, and the title was written in Hebrew, Greek, and in Latin. Now we might follow the mistaken notion that when Jesus was taken to be crucified, he was taken out into the countryside, out into some out of sight, out of mind sort of a place. Some remote area, or behind a wall. Not so. Not so. The place of the crucifixion was very, very near to the city. Now, we're going to go to Matthew's Gospel 27, and soon we'll be back to John 19. Further information from Matthew chapter 27 at verse 39. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 27, and the 39th verse. And this we further learn about the place where Jesus was crucified. Verse 39, they that passed by reviled him, they wagged their heads. The 40th verse, and they said, you who destroys the temple, rebuilds in 3 days, then save yourself if you're the Messiah, and get down from that cross. Now, what does this tell us? This tells us that not only was the place of crucifixion nearby to the city, but it was alongside a main highway. It was a part of the punishment of the crucifixion that the condemned have their crosses raised alongside the main thoroughfare. And in our context here today, we would say the cross was raised here at the connection of Interstate 5 and Garden Valley. So the largest number of people in their travels, whether going from home to the workplace or returning, or going on vacations or on business trips, they could stop in the shadow of the cross, look into the face of he who hung, cast their rotten epithets, their dirty four-letter words, pick up stones, and stone the helpless and defenseless. So the place where he was crucified was not only just near to the, barely outside the wall, it was also alongside the main highway. They that passed by reviled him, laughed at him, and tortured him. Now, we're going to ask and answer, where was the tomb? Because that's going to become important. Back again to John's Gospel 19, now verse 41. Chapter 19 and the 41st verse. Now the place where he was crucified, in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden. And in that garden, there was a tomb where never before had been placed. And there they laid Jesus, therefore, because of the Jews' preparation day, and the tomb was near at hand. Now again, we in our imaginings might suppose that once he died, His body was taken in a funeral cortege or parade somewhere into the countryside for a burial, but not so. The place of the crucifixion and the place of the tomb were so near in proximity that they were said to be one and the same. The place where he was crucified, there was a tomb, and there they placed his body. Now we've talked about time and place. We need to talk about people. Who was there when Jesus was put on the cross? History says that a crucifixion was a point of gathering. Someone not long ago compared it to the Woodstock, a generation or so back, I guess. It was a happening. And folks would come from the Galilee area, they would come from over along the Mediterranean shores, they would come from over in Jericho, and they wanted to be on time to see the nails driven. That was the exciting part. For the average man struggled, tried his best to break one fist free, to smack his executioners in the nose, one final rebellion. So a crowd would gather around the place of crucifixion, but once the nails were driven, and the cross was raised and in place, then quickly the crowds thinned out. Their lust for blood had been sated. There were, however, three women and one young man by the name of John who stayed beside the cross. One of those women was the mother of Jesus. Still another was her sister. And another was Mary of Magdala, and the young man was John, now probably about 21 or 22 years of age only. In addition, there were four Roman soldiers, the muscle kind. It was their responsibility now to make certain that no one took his body down and dressed his wounds, took him away somewhere to repair. Crowds are gone. There's no threat. This young guy and those three women aren't going to make any attempt to take his body. It's all relaxed now. And so to pass the time, these four Roman soldiers took dice in their hands and began to play games in the dust at the foot of the cross. And then momentarily in their gaming, one of them stopped, stood up, looked into the face of Jesus, and then into the heavens, and fairly shouted, "Surely this was the Son of God!" Now I've wondered, what was there about those final moments that brought this kind of conviction and conversion to the heart of the Roman soldier? I'd like to share three ideas with you very quickly. Number one, the marvelous patience of Jesus. Marvelous patience. While a couple of others were struggling and straining and trying to fight, Jesus of his own volition walked to his cross, laid down upon it and spread his arms, and in cadence with the ring of the hammer upon the nail, he was praying, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Please lay not this into their charge. Forgive them." And this Roman executioner had never seen anything like it. And then there was the second factor, the cry of victory. He's on the cross really only just a short time, and he shouts out, "It is finished." I read a dissertation a while back that suggested those were among the most tragic words ever spoken. His idea was this: Jesus had come here to do good. He'd walked the weary miles, blisters on his feet, opened every blinded eye that he came in contact with, straightened every twisted, withered limb, comforted every hurting heart, blessed every child. And while at the outset there were great crowds and thousands of followers, when he comes to the end of it all, standing beside his cross, his mom, his aunt, and another young lady and a young guy, and his attitude was, "I gave it my best shot. I really tried. But it's over and I'm a failure. I'm done." But you and I know better than that, of course. It was the greatest shout of victory the universe ever would hear. For mission impossible was mission accomplished. Salvation now guaranteed to every man, woman, and child that would trust and believe. It is guaranteed. It's finished now. I've done it. Three men found a conversion at the cross. But the third event that brought conversion to the heart of the soldier was the sudden death of Jesus. You can be certain he'd been in charge of many crucifixions and executions, but he'd never seen one like this before. Marvelous patience, cry of victory. And then he's only on the cross a few short hours, and he lowered his head upon his chest, and he died. Now, traditionally, a man lived on a cross 3 or 4 days. But if he's a young man, and Jesus was, and if he's in good physical condition, and surely Jesus was, not unusual that a man live on the cross for 7 to 10 days until he died as a result of dehydration together with starvation, blood poisoning around the wounds. Some died of sheer madness as they hung, unable to even swat the flies, and the birds pecked out their eyes while they lived. But Jesus dies suddenly. Marvelous patience, the cry of victory, and the sudden death. And so we find three men at the scene of the cross who find conversion. One of them is a Jew. He's the thief on the right-hand side who recognizes in Jesus hope for today and forever. Lord, remember me when you come as king. And Jesus promised him eternity. The man was a Jew. And the second man to find conversion was Simon of Cyrene. It was he who carried the cross the last several yards after Jesus fainted beneath its weight. Cyrene is on the African continent, and history says, trustable history, I believe, that Simon was a black man. And the third man to find conversion was a man, the Roman soldier, who said, truly this was the Son of God, and he, of course, was a Gentile. So we have the conversion of a Jew, the thief on the right-hand side, a black man from Africa, and a Roman soldier. A foretaste that the value of the death of Jesus Christ was for everybody. Every man, woman, and child, regardless of the origin of your birth, no matter the color of your skin, Jesus died for all of us. Now, into this very dangerous environment, suddenly come two of the three wealthiest men in all of Palestine and claim discipleship, this being Nicodemus and the other Joseph from Arimathea. Now, this is really out of context, folks. Remember, the disciples have gone into hiding. Why? They were afraid they'd be accused of being friends of Jesus, and they too would be executed. Simon Peter was found standing by the devil's fire, and someone recognized him, said, you're one of his friends, you're one of his followers. No. You look like, well, everyone has a double. Well, you have that Galilean accent. And so he began to swear, your language shows that you're one. No! And he changed the way he talked and cursed. Why? He was fearful that he would be crucified. And now into this very dangerous environment, when it is so very dangerous to be considered even a friend, these two very wealthy men come forward. And Joseph from Arimathea furnishes a tomb carved out of the living rock. And when a man had a tomb carved out of the stone, that meant that his grandfather, likely, or perhaps even a great-grandfather, had hired a crew to spend a lifetime with a hammer in one hand and a chisel in the other. Only the very wealthy had tombs carved out of the stone. The second wealthy man is Nicodemus. By the way, both of these guys were members of the governing body of Jews, the Sanhedrin. And while Joseph is dusting out the tomb, Nicodemus is embalming the body of Jesus with 100 pounds of myrrh and aloes. And I looked it up, still, and just recently, concentrated myrrh is selling for $10,000 for 1 pound. Some have suggested that it cost Nicodemus $10,000 in our equivalency to embalm the body of Jesus. Now, the corpse was covered with the embalming spices, and then there was a bandage that began at the toes and the ankles and was wound around the corpse up to the armpits, and then another layer of spice, another layer of bandage, one final layer of spice, and one final winding of the bandage. And now I must tell you what they called that winding bandage: swaddling clothes. Now, Jesus was born in a manger, wrapped in grave clothes the moment of his birth. "For this cause came I into the world," said Jesus. On a death mission, Jesus came and was born. Now, because a man lived on a cross traditionally for several days, there would be ample time for funeral and burial arrangements. But not so with Jesus. He dies quickly. What to do with the corpse? His disciples were by and large fishermen, impoverished basically, with perhaps one or two exceptions. And if they had a burial plot at all, it wouldn't be here. It would be some 50 miles north up in the Galilee basin. When the indigent died on the cross, his body generally was taken down, grabbed around the ankles by one guard and beneath the armpits by the other, and taken over to the backside of Calvary's Hill, where it would be swung two and then let go on the three, and down into the city dump it would roll. And the Bible calls this place Gehenna. It says the fires always burned and the worms always were there. So into this situation now come these two wealthy men, and they go to Pontius Pilate and they say, "Mr. Pilate, we're not going to allow his body to be thrown into the dump. We're going to give him a decent burial." And Pilate cannot, will not believe that he's dead. What kind of shenaniganism is this? Can't be dead. No one dies on a cross in just a few short hours. And so he calls in the chief executioner. He said, "These guys say Jesus is dead and they want to take his body down. What's going on out there?" And the executioner said, "Sir, I'd never seen anything like it either. You know, I've been in charge of many, many of these crucifixion executions. He'd only been on the cross a short time. He shouted with a loud voice. He said, 'It's finished.' And then he lowered his head. I thought he was faking it. I stood beneath him for the longest time. I watched for the slightest movement of his diaphragm or his rib cage. There was none. And then I thought perhaps he's taught himself how to breathe without its showing. And so to make certain that he wasn't faking it, I took my spear as I stood beneath him and I rammed it up beneath the rib cage and into the heart cavity, and I saw the expulsion. You can be certain that he is dead." Now, only under and after that certainty was his body given over to be buried, taken from the cross. I read another book a while back whose theme suggested that Jesus didn't die on the cross. It's called The Passover Plot. Maybe you've heard of it. He didn't die on the cross. He just faked that his friends took him down and staunched his bleeding and took him away, perhaps to the coast of Africa. And there he lived a full life and died a natural death. Let's examine that idea. Did Nicodemus believe that he was dead? He'd embalmed his body, absolutely. Did Joseph from Arimathea believe Jesus was dead? Yeah. He placed his body in the tomb, laid it on the shelf. He knew Jesus was dead. What about the Roman soldiers? Did they believe it? Yes, they knew he was dead. Of certainty, they knew he was dead. And then there was this great stone, this cartwheel-sized stone, about 8 feet in diameter, 10 to 12 inches in thickness, that was rolled into the slot in front of the portal of the tomb. It took four men to roll that stone into its slot. It would take 10 men to roll it up out of there. What about those four men who rolled the stone in place? Did they believe Jesus was dead? It'd be a terrible thing to entomb a living man. Yes, they knew he was dead. Bible says that there were some women who looked inside and saw how his body was placed and then went home to keep the Sabbath, planning to come back and further anoint him on Sunday morning. Did they believe he was dead? Certainly. The enemies of Jesus, those who for years had plotted and planned and schemed his death, were certain that he was dead, and only under and after that certainty did they allow his body to be entombed in the cross. In the tomb. Now, we want to read what happens next, and so we go again to Matthew chapter 27, and we note at verse 62 and following. Matthew 27 and verse 62. Oh, it gets good now. I mean, no mystery writer could ever spell it down like this. Matthew 27, beginning with the 62nd verse and reading down to the end. Now, the day that followed the preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate and they said, "Sir, we remember that deceiver while he was still alive said, 'After 3 days I'll rise again.' Command therefore that the sepulcher be made sure until the third day, lest the disciples come at night and steal his body and say to the people he's risen from the dead. And the last error be worse than the first." And Pilate said to them, "You have the watch. Go your way. Make it as sure as you can." And so they went and made the sepulcher sure, put a seal upon the stone, and placed the guards in front. By the way, notice the doubt in the mind of Pontius Pilate. He's dead. All right, look, I'll give you what you want. 101 guards, keep him in there if you can. See if you can keep him in. From the moment their eyes locked together in Pilate's judgment hall, Pilate knew that Jesus was innocent. And added to his own intuition, there was the influence of his wife who came running down the staircase shouting, "Dear, don't let anyone harm him. In a dream I've seen he's an innocent. Don't let them hurt him." But Pilate was the weak, vacillating, pusillanimous politician. He tried to please everyone, ended up pleasing no one at all. You have a custom. It's a custom that I release someone at this time of year. I tell you, I'm going to release him. "No," they shouted, "no. Release Barabbas." Now, Barabbas was worse than a seditionist. He was a terrible criminal. "What shall I do then with Jesus?" "Crucify him. Finish him off." So Pilate said, "Here are the guards, 101. Keep them in there if you can. Make it as certain as you can." Now, let's rethink this scenario. When did these chief priests go to see Pontius Pilate? On what day of the week was it? Come on. Well, the Sabbath day, of course. The day following the preparation. That's the Sabbath. You say, "Well, so what?" No Jew ever crossed the threshold of a Gentile's home or office on any day of the week, certainly not on the Sabbath. The fact that they would go to see Pilate on the Sabbath really underlines their concern. They said, "While he was still alive, he said, 'I'll rise again.' We need help." And Pilate said, "You sure do. Here's the help. Make it as sure and as certain as you can." In the word centurion, there is the word century. 100 years a century, 100 men under the command of a centurion. Now, let's talk together about the resurrection. When did it happen? see them now, 101 men standing through the night. Heavy iron weapons and shields, helmets and armor. And it's such a ridiculous mission. I mean, it's not like we're guarding the tomb of a president or Elvis Presley. I mean, this is a nobody. What are we doing here? And more than that, this is Passover weekend. There's a barbecue in every backyard, and there are games all over town. And here we stand guarding this no one. The darkest hour is just before the dawning. And just as the morning sun begins to lighten the eastern sky, the spring breeze begins to waft through the garden and carry with it the aroma of the spring blossoms, and it's hypnotic. Their weapons are heavy, and heavier still are their eyelids. They can barely stay awake, barely. Suddenly it's as bright as daylight. An angel of God comes streaking through the sky shouting, "Jesus, thy Father calleth thee," and the stone is rolled away with unseen hand. Now, see those guards, 101 of them, flat on their backs. They can't move, they're paralyzed, but they can see. Jesus walked out of the open grave and just simply walked away. And after they'd regained their composure, the Bible says that some of those guards went into Pilate and told it as it was. It didn't make up some story. How could you? He's out there. We did our job. I tell you, there was an earthquake, and the stone rolled by itself, and he just walked out and walked away. Now, see the blood drain from the face of Pilate. But more importantly, as they told the story to the scribes and the Pharisees, the temple priests, watch their knees begin to knock together. Now their worst fears were confirmed. They'd been running from him since the day he'd overturned their tables in the temple, and they were certain that they would meet him alone in some dark alley. And so they said to these Roman soldiers, "Look, if this story gets out, it's going to cause a rebellion. I tell you what, look, you say this, you guards, and go tell the rest of them, you were all asleep. You were all sleeping, and while you were asleep, the disciples came and took away his body. And they put a story in their mouths and money in their hands." Now, there were two big problems with that lie. Number one, no Roman guard, while on guard duty, ever slept at the post. If he was caught sleeping, he paid with his life. It was a capital offense. Number two, if they were also soundly asleep, how did they know his disciples took the body? Someone must have been peeking. Do you suppose that those guards always told that lie? Do you suppose? We know better, don't we? We know human nature far too well. Our president or some great official has a top drawer meeting. I mean, this is hush, hush. Information by necessity only. And before the meeting is over, CNN is broadcasting it. How would you keep a story like this quiet? I am fascinated no end by the rapid growth of the Christian church in the first and second centuries. You talk about evangelism explosion. I mean, the Apostle Paul, before the end of his ministry, could say, "This gospel has now reached every corner of the known world. It's gone everywhere." How do you account for it? I'll tell you how you can certainly, in great part, account for it. These Roman soldiers were the advance guard. They were the missionaries. They were conscripts. They were drafted from throughout the Roman Empire. And when they returned home from their assignments, be certain they called in the neighbors from both sides of the house and across the street, and the grandparents, the aunties and the uncles, and the folks from the backyard fence, and they told it. They said, "I was on guard duty. It was Passover weekend, and we saw him die. We were certain of that, and we stood through the night, And then the next morning there was an earthquake, and he came out of there. He's alive. He's out there somewhere. He is alive today. Watch what the devil has done. He's overstepped himself. Puts 101 men in front of the tomb to keep Jesus in, and all he accomplishes is putting there 101 credible eyewitnesses to the truth that Jesus is alive. I love it, don't you? I just love it. What a story. Mary from Magdala, the last to leave the cross, is the first at the open tomb on Sunday morning. Tears are in her eyes. She sees the stone is rolled away. She's heard the rumor, supposed rumor. And she looks in, and his body is gone. Vandals. And she turns away, and there she sees a man in the garden whom she believes is the caretaker. And she says, sir, tell me where you've taken his body, and I'll take care of it now. I always admired her courage. I'll take care of him. And it was Jesus. They said, Mary, go tell the disciples now. You know where they are. Go tell them that I'm alive just like I promised, and I will meet them at our appointment. Oh, and be sure you tell whom? Peter. Yeah. Tell all the guys, but be sure you find Peter wherever he is. Tell Peter, I saw him beside the devil's fire. Tell him I heard what he said, the oaths and the denials. Tell him I know all about that. But tell Peter, I still love him. And nothing has changed. Give Peter back his self-respect. And every single day, God sends angel messengers on missions of mercy. Go to Portland. Go down to Medford. And go to Roseburg and tell Lyle. I know what he did. I know what he said. But give him back his self-respect. Tell him I still love him. Peter and John have a foot race now to the open tomb. And John gets there first. I used to think, well, he was a little, you know, better up on his jogging. But the reality is that he was only about 21 years of age, and Peter was probably around 55. That makes some difference. And when John gets there, he's just a little bit fearful, a little skeptical. And when Peter arrives out of breath, he's not skeptical. This guy will jump out of the boat, and he goes right inside. Come on in, John. It's okay. Come on in. Look at this. And he saw the winding bandages placed here and the napkin over the face placed there. By the way, that truth completely shatters the idea of the Shroud of Turin. Two separate items, a napkin over his face. And John came in, and he was convinced by the evidence of the winding bandages. Not so very long ago, I went again to the tomb. I shall show it to you folks next Friday evening, where they say Jesus was buried. I had with me my associate at the time, and I said to Benjamin, would you please guard the tomb? Would you be a guard for just 5 minutes? If anyone comes, would you ask them please to just give me 5 minutes alone? And I went inside the tomb, where once the great stone was, there is now a batten board door. And as the light flooded the tomb, as I opened the door, I could see a shelf with a little niche where a head would rest. I allowed the door to close, and I went over to the shelf, and I knelt and prayed and wept and worshiped. And then I got up to exit, and I opened the door, and there on the backside I saw a sign, a hand-lettered sign, simple sign, a quotation from a holy angel, and it said, "He is not here, for he has risen." Now sing with me. Number 526, because he lives. 526.